Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The natural migration will be towards the studio one-bedroom apartments where the real crisis is for families. I mean, I think that the price of a two-bedroom apartment has become a sort of form of birth control in Manhattan.
The price of a two-bedroom apartment has become a form of birth control in Manhattan, said a caller to the show, Jessica Manhattan, from a few weeks ago. It's a family meeting on rent on the Brian Lehrer Show today. And we use that clip as prelude to ask, will the de Blasio affordable housing plan stop the crazy rent inflation in New York City? We are happy to have Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn with us on the city's ambitious new blueprint. Deputy Mayor, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
The Bloomberg administration had its voluntary 80-20 formula, offering developers more height on their buildings in exchange for 20% of the apartments being made affordable. You're going for a different ratio, where the goal for many advocates is often more like 20-30-50. Is something like 20-30-50 your numerical goal?
Well, I think that, you know, we've been very clear that what we need to do is have a much more mixed income approach when we are using all of our housing tools. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that there is the inclusionary piece of that, which currently under the voluntary program, it is a 20% set aside for affordable housing when you voluntarily do inclusionary housing. But there are many, many other programmatic requirements that stem from the way housing is financed that also have led to that 80-20 sort of in the ether. So that's also how our tax exemptions have been working and how much of the federal funding has come down, which encourages the 80-20 model. You know, one of the things we're very focused on is making sure that we can serve a much wider range of incomes. And so what the plan lays out is really specific targets to make sure that our most low-income families as well as our middle-income families have an opportunity to share in the affordable housing agenda.
So something like 20-30-50 means 20% for really low-income people, 30 kind of middle-moderate income housing, and 50% market rate?
Well, that's one model, and there are some examples of that right now. Actually, where the mayor made his announcement in Brooklyn yesterday is a 50-30-20 of that model that's going into the ground right now. We also lay out in the plan that we want to play with some other variations of that. We really think there isn't a one-size-fits-all. You know, we are going to look at different types of 50-30-20s where even the 50 may be capped at middle-income rents, and there wouldn't actually be a market rate component. I think when you look at the various neighborhoods and the needs in the neighborhoods, we're going to have to align our various incentive programs to really respond to the needs of the market and the neighborhoods. So again, it's getting away from a one-size-fits-all approach and really working to understand what the market conditions are and who the populations are in the various neighborhoods, because we are committed to serving a much wider range of folks.
So on the market conditions in the city as a whole, the New York Times article on the plan today says some cities such as Boston and Denver already require projects over a certain size to set aside affordable units. Mm-hmm. But housing experts say there's a downside. The requirement can reduce or eliminate profits and dissuade developers from building, says the Times. So why won't this mandatory inclusionary zoning mean a higher percentage of affordable apartments, but in a context of less new supply overall, because developers won't have the incentive to build that they did before, than if you did nothing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very complex question with respect to where the market is at any given time. But what we are going to be doing is not over the next couple of months, you know, imposing a mandatory inclusionary requirement across the city. That is not the way that the program will be rolled out. Neighborhood by neighborhood, the city is going to be working with communities to rezone neighborhoods where we think that there are opportunities to build significant housing and mixed-use projects. And when the city then upzones or rezones those neighborhoods and creates that value, we will be looking at what the market conditions are and make sure that the ratios that we impose are not going to create a tipping point where we're disincentivizing development. The mayor has been very clear that we are pro-development and that part of our density agenda is to capture what is an incredibly strong market here and make sure that those neighborhoods where we are creating density and opportunity for folks includes a fair percentage of affordable housing. So we don't think, and we certainly have no intention of designing a program where the tipping point would be reached, because then we would be undermining our own objectives.
So 200,000 units to be created or preserved over the next decade. It sounds like a lot. The Times editorial on this calls it de Blasio's moonshot, because that number is seen as so high. But I see that most of that is housing to be preserved, and only 80,000 additional affordable units compared to today over the next 10 years in a city of 8 million people. That barely keeps up with population growth and isn't enough to change the basic picture of affordability, is it?
Well, I mean, I would say a couple of things. One, the 200,000 units is the most ambitious affordable housing plan ever proposed by a municipality in the country. So that's the affordable stock, not our overall production targets. Second of all, I think to say that, you know, we are overemphasizing preservation is not, in fact, correct. 120,000 units to be preserved is an extraordinary opportunity to make sure that we can maintain the income diversity that really is the backbone of the city, and protect decades and decades of public sector investment, but also decades and decades of people committing to those neighborhoods and staying in those buildings. So we can't de-emphasize the fact that really aggressively going out and preserving housing that has either been subsidized or has been subject to regulation stays in the system is incredibly important. As you've seen, the data shows that the number of units that have gone out of regulation over the past decade has really accelerated the problem. And so we are fundamentally committed to making sure that that housing stays in the system.
Right. And my question...
And then on the new construction side, Brian,
yes.
80,000 units of new affordable housing is an extraordinary increase over any other city's attempt to ever build that much affordable housing, and a significant increase over both the Bloomberg plan and the Koch plans, which were focused mostly on rehabilitation and not increasing the overall stock.
Right. And my question is not intended to suggest that you're not being as ambitious as you think you can possibly be, but just to reflect how difficult it is to really change the landscape. I mean, the Bloomberg administration created or preserved 165,000 over 12 years, and look how much higher the average rents are anyway than when they came in. So my question is, with all that you can do, with all the billions you can throw into it and trying to squeeze money out of Albany and Washington and everything else, is this just a matter of 80,000 more families winning lotteries for affordable units that will remain scarce in a city built for luxury?
Well, I mean, I think to say just 80,000 units is, again, de minimizing how much of a dent we think this will make into the existing problem. I mean, 80,000 units will translate into housing for close to 250,000 people, and that's an extraordinary undertaking. And it's not just a question of winning a lottery. We're going to have a very, very systemic approach to where we're building this housing, working with neighborhoods to identify whether the needs are for senior housing and smaller units, or whether we need to be driving production for larger families, because one of the things that we've seen is that because the housing stock no longer accurately reflects the demographic makeup of the city, is that we may, in fact, if we do this correctly, be able to free up additional housing that is already in the stock, right? So the classic example of seniors in particular who may be staying in a one- or two-bedroom apartment because there are no viable alternatives, if we can create a way in which people can be housed in the type of housing that they should be at this stage of their own projection, we should then be able to also ease some of the backlog. So we're really trying to be thoughtful about the whole housing ecosystem here and think about who are New Yorkers today, who are going to be the New Yorkers over the next decade, and understand that the affordable housing agenda is obviously only one piece of that puzzle. We need to continue to work with the real estate industry so that we can streamline our processes. We're going to be removing various barriers to construction and to the zoning process in order to make it easier for people to build. Because if we do this right, for every affordable unit, we should also be seeing an increase in the market rate stock so that we can begin to really make a dent in the overall housing crisis.
And when you talk about making it easier to build, I saw you say on New York One last night, or maybe it was your colleague Vicky Bean, I'm not sure which of you it was, that you've had constructive conversations between union and non-union builders, and that to be affordable to rent, housing has to be affordable to build, and that unions are open to taking some lower wages. So Is this administration, which is famous for trying to increase the minimum and living wages in New York, trying to lower wages of construction workers as part of this plan?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, I think that what is extraordinary about this whole effort is that everybody in the city and sets of people who historically have not all come together around these issues are prepared to come to the table around these issues because the crisis has really reached a new high. So that if 55% of New Yorkers are technically rent burdened, and that means they're paying more than one-third of their income on housing alone, everybody has an interest to sit down and figure out how to do this. The disparity between what the union labor costs are and what non-union labor costs are, you know, does have a real impact on our ability to drive forward on the plan. And so the fact that the unions are meeting with developers and advocates to talk about identifying a wage rate that would allow them to participate more fully in the program is a fantastic step forward. That said, even if the city finances housing that is not built by unions, we absolutely will have at least a living wage as our standard. There's a big gap between a living wage and a union wage, and we think that if we can reach some middle point there, we will actually see increased production, lower costs, and quality jobs being created for folks who can then not just participate in building the affordable housing plan, but then also have the skills they need to grow into the trades and work on non-residential projects, for example. So we think this is a real opportunity to link the economic development engine of a $41 billion plan to other goals around skills building, growing the workforce, integrating the workforce into our other programs, so that it's a real win for New Yorkers.
But just to finish that point, are you suggesting that there's a middle wage between the living wage, which is still relatively low, and the union wage, and so that union wage needs to come down for some of these coming projects?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is, and we've been having conversations with various members of the trades, and they recognize that they have a real interest in opening up their ranks and participating in this program in a way that they historically have not, and that because of the scope of this agenda and the different building typologies, they have indicated a willingness to talk about a wage reduction for their members that would allow them to have more people coming into the unions, create more apprenticeships, and have really a much bigger impact on the plan. Mm-hmm. So we're not taking a position on exactly what that wage rate should be, but they have indicated to us a willingness to really reduce their base wage when we're talking about constructing affordable housing, and we really welcome that.
Interesting. Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn, as we talk about the de Blasio administration's new affordable housing blueprint, and one key to this is convincing neighborhoods that density is good. Mm-hmm. But generally, people don't want more density in their neighborhoods. Who wants the high-rise to go up on the corner of their block in Brownstone, Brooklyn, et cetera? So you say you'll build this from the ground up, neighborhood by neighborhood, in consultation. But will you have to force this on many neighborhoods to reach the production goal?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think we should also redefine what the word density means. I mean, I think that there has been, you know, people associate density now with exactly what you just did, Brian, which is saying there's going to be a tower in my backyard. And when you actually look at what we're talking about with respect to density in many of the neighborhoods where we think there is really fantastic infrastructure and opportunities to do smart development, particularly around where there's access to mass transit, density in those cases can mean going from a 3- or 4-story building to going to a 6- or 8-story building and actually building back to what has been the historical density in many of the boroughs. So we're not talking about shoving towers down people's throats in various neighborhoods. We're talking about working with people to identify corridors and neighborhoods where appropriate densification will result in a huge amount of housing production. And with that housing production comes many of the retail and community services that neighborhoods will be able to embrace as a whole to make those neighborhoods more livable and more vibrant. And so that kind of conversation is going to start right now. The planning department is initiating a whole series of community-based planning studies and will be launching what they expect to be a dozen potential rezoning efforts over the next year, where we will work with the community to say, hey, you know, a 6 to 8 story building plus a supermarket, plus we're organizing our capital planning efforts to make sure that we have the right number of school seats. And we're also going to be able to then justify putting in more open space, investing more in the neighborhood because there is an increase in population. So we really see this as a healthy discussion around what makes these neighborhoods incredibly vital. And by the way, when asked, most people, it's their own neighbors or it's their own families who are desperate for affordable housing. And so when you start talking to folks about the fact that it's their mother or their kid coming back from college who can no longer live, you know, within their own neighborhood or within their own borough, the whole conversation changes really dramatically.
Indeed.
Because it really resonates with folks.
But does density really create more affordability in the long run anyway? Haven't we seen in places like Williamsburg and all over Manhattan that when the higher buildings come in, even with a percentage set aside for affordable, that that means gentrification? So market rates rise in the neighborhood as a whole, commercial rents rise, and local merchants get forced out, and there are costs, economic costs to density, not just economic benefits?
Well, I think that, I mean, we do believe very strongly that when we begin to build these neighborhoods and have an array of incomes that are not just very low, but also beginning to create a whole housing resource for folks in the moderate and middle income range, combined with very serious enforcement of rent regulation, we believe that, in fact, we will make a dent in what has become, for many people, you're right, rapidly, rapidly changing neighborhoods, which have set many people, you know, out of their neighborhoods and feeling like, where is my neighborhood? And I think that what we're very focused on is making sure that we're coupling our preservation efforts, our new construction efforts, and our enforcement efforts in a very proactive and thoughtful way so that we can attack this whole problem in a much more holistic way. I think you're right. Over the past decade, many of the efforts with respect to affordable housing have been linked exclusively to the development of luxury housing, and that affordable housing is a byproduct of luxury housing. And I think it's fair to say that that has not produced what people need to see in the neighborhoods. And so we're very focused on moving away from that paradigm into a much more proactive and comprehensive approach to marrying the preservation piece, the new construction piece, a wider range of incomes, and being very, very aggressive with all of our enforcement tools to make sure that those neighborhoods can stay economically diverse.
It's a great vision if you can pull it off. But let me follow up with one more question.
Sure.
As a progressive administration, do you have to change people's basic notion of what progressive urbanism is? And I don't think the icon of progressive urbanism, Jane Jacobs, for example, was a fan of density. Towers on a plaza as a model for public or private housing has been largely discredited in terms of quality of life. But you're saying you can get landlords to give you enough affordable housing in buildings that are as small as 6 to 8 stories. Can you really, or don't you need to let them build a lot higher than that in many, many cases in order to make the profit that they need to make and then still give you the 20, 30, 50%?
Well, again, the 20, 30, 50% is not the mandatory inclusionary program. I do want folks to understand there are many, many different levers we're going to be using. So it may be that in a district where the maximum you can build to is a 6 or 8 story building, there may be an ability to impose a mandatory requirement that allows us to build a few units there. But we can also be using our other tools in those neighborhoods, and the city is going to be putting a substantial amount of their own capital behind this plan so that we can also help those buildings attain a level of middle income or moderate income housing. I think with respect to the Tower and the Park and the Jane Jacobs issue, I think everybody would agree that those are outdated modes of thinking about what makes a healthy city. And so our view is that to the extent that we can use this housing agenda to create livelier street walls, connect people back into the urban grid, and support better quality retail and community services, that's exactly what we think progressive urbanism is all about, not isolating people in towers in the park, but integrating them back into the lifeblood of the city and reconnecting folks to neighborhoods. So I think, you know, it's obviously very complex, but we think that between using our zoning power, putting our own money behind this plan, working with the state and federal government for them to also participate, and aligning our incentive programs, we can really make a dent in a way that people should be able to feel, you know, within the next couple of years.
A minute left for anything you want to say about the housing blueprint.
No, you know, look, we are incredibly excited about how many stakeholders have come to the table to do this. I mean, unlike previous plans, we've met with hundreds of people ranging from advocates to developers to labor to supportive housing advocates. And we think that this really represents an unbelievable opportunity in the face of a crisis for so many different people to come to the table and be willing to work with us to identify sites to build, neighborhoods to preserve, statutes that we should amend, all with the drive of creating a more affordable, and quite frankly, without having an affordable and diverse city, how are we going to continue to be the global city that we've been to date? Housing is fundamentally the building block of our economy and what makes New York City so great. And so we really look forward to rolling it out over the next decade.
If it works, it'll be a much better city. Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn, thank you for giving us this time.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's a family meeting on rent on the Brian Lehrer Show today. And let's talk about that density question. What has greater density meant for your neighborhood? Has it been good in any neighborhood? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Is anyone listening right now who wants more density for your neighborhood? Would that improve your quality of life? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I want to give the deputy mayor her due. She was trying to lay out a vision of density that is not the old towers on a square or towers in a park vision that she agreed has been discredited in terms of quality of life, a model for positive urban living. So what kind of density has worked in your neighborhood, if any? 212-433-9692. The mayor's plan mentions much of Atlantic Avenue and also East New York and Cypress Hills as areas where density, rather than being unwelcome clutter, might be a welcome improvement, something that they're actually asking for. So listeners, how do you feel about density that has come to your neighborhood? Are there any situations, because I know we're going to get flooded with people who are saying, oh, it ruined the Upper West Side, it's ruining Williamsburg. Any place where it's been good, done in a smart way, in New York or elsewhere? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and we'll take your calls right after this.